Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the Dr. Will Show, where I interview educators and entrepreneurs on leveling up. Each episode, I zoom in someone who's dope. We'll just sit back and have a conversation on what it means to live your best life. Now, if this is your first time checking out the podcast, this is the Mobile University for Entrepreneurs, and I'm your host, Dr. Will. Today's guest is Dr. Robert Simmons III, and we're going to be talking about his experiences in education, his experiences going in as an entrepreneur, what he's been doing, and get some insights with him about what is going on and what does it take for you to be successful in this game, particularly when you're an educator coming from a non-business background and everything that you have to deal with, the mindsets, the ideas around money, the obstacles in getting the right information to take you from idea to actual launch. And so we're going to get into that so that you can be better prepared to be successful and even scale what you're already doing. So for those who will be listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Simplecast, Stitcher, and Audible, will you please introduce yourself, Dr. Robert?
Yeah, good afternoon, morning, good night, evening, whatever folks got going on. I'm Robert Simmons, head of social impact at Micron Technology and the Micron Foundation. We are one of the largest producers of semiconductors in the world, and the foundation is deeply committed to issues around STEM, issues in food insecurity, housing, basic human needs, water, things of that sort, as well as university relations and supporting folks at universities doing great STEM work. Also am a scholar in residence and a scholar of anti-racist praxis at American University in education policy and leadership. So still stay connected to education, but also am enjoying my work in corporate philanthropy.
All right. So I'm always curious as to how people got to where they are. What did you think you would be doing when you were growing up, and what got you interested in education?
You know, when I was a senior in high school, I had a service project at a school in Detroit, born in Atlanta, raised in Detroit. And when I saw the impact that I had with a little group of third graders at the school, I was immediately hooked. And I knew at that moment I wanted to be a teacher. So I went to college to be a teacher. Like, I didn't want to do anything else. That was it. Like, I was an education major. Actually, was a triple minor. I don't even know if they have that program anymore. It's so long ago. But and I just knew I wanted to be in education. And I think that, as I have said to numerous people, education is one of the greatest political acts, in particular for people of color and Black folks, specifically in our community, that we can engage in, because it's fundamentally a political act, contrary to what some people say.
Before we go to this next question, you said that I've always thought about the hardest part of what we're doing, particularly when you work in K-12, when you're working with students who may be third generation in public assistance or third generation working class, and they're around family members who are not doing well at the next level economically. Same thing with the community members that they see. So they're not seeing things that allow them to dream per se, right? And so what you see a lot of time in K-12 is we'll focus on the grades. We'll focus on the test scores. We'll focus on these things that to me have nothing to do with what I call the hope gap.
Yeah, I love it.
Right. And so, but in doing that, the difficult part in that job is getting that student to not necessarily turn their backs on their families or their communities, but to get them to sort of see and embrace the idea that in order for you to be better and do better, you cannot do what you see. You cannot make the same decisions as the individuals that are in your family or in your community. If not, you will stay right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in zip code 48210 in Detroit, and it had a well-earned reputation and still does as one of the most violent zip codes in the state of Michigan, right? And I think this idea of the hope gap is where this idea of the village is so important in our communities, right? And I think that we've far too many communities, not all, have moved away from the village, right? Where if you got in trouble at school, it was a long walk home because everybody knew before you got home, right? And so I think, you know, and I'm not talking about people giving you a whooping or a spanking, right? I mean, I grew up in a generation where you got a spanking, right? But certainly the ability as a village to care for young people, to wrap arms around them, almost in the way that I think about our 11-year-old who plays AAU basketball. And if I can't go to practice, another parent will make sure he's good, right? And it's like, well, if we can build a village around kids in sports, we should be able to build a village around our children outside of sports, right? Making sure they get home. If we know that two parents are working third shift, somebody else has to step in and help be that extended family, not by blood, right? And I think that that's a piece that's missing, and it's not something that's taught to educators in particular, because I think educators can play that role. But I also think that there's a broader responsibility in the community to help play that role. And I think that there are a lot of organizations helping to do that. And I think it's important for us to build a network to do that. And I'm really big on that and really thinking about, there's a book I'm reading called Connecting to Change the World. And it's all about the power of networks for social impact, and really has reframed how I think about social impact and doing good in the world. And the same with education, where I'm just thinking about how can we wrap our arms around our kids who have this hope gap, because hope should be distributed evenly, right? Opportunity and access is not, but hope should be distributed evenly, and dreams should be distributed evenly across our democracy. But unfortunately, it's not.
No doubt, no doubt. So the thing about this podcast that hopefully, if you've been listening to it, you understand that I'm all about educators creating multiple streams of income, thinking of themselves as a business of one, so they can take ownership over their lives and their careers and the things that they actually want in life, and not be someone who's just sort of in the passenger seat and languishing wherever they are. For those educators who are thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, whether that's writing a book, offering a mastermind, creating and selling a course, and things of that nature, there is a steep learning curve for them, because, well, how do you do it? And the thing you have to sort of navigate as well is there's a lot of information on business online and in books, and a lot of that canon will not necessarily directly translate in our field because of just of how things sort of operate. Like a university, because, or a K-12 institution, because of how rules work around financing, you can't just, they can't just go, oh, I'm going to hire this person.
That's right.
For $80,000, because people look at them like you're crazy. But if you, but Microsoft could bring you in as a speaker and pay you $60,000 for an hour, and no one would blink at it because they could do whatever they want to do.
That's right.
When you're an educator and you're thinking about, this is something that I want to do, what should they know before actually starting a business? And how did you get yourself mentally ready to go all in?
You know, I don't think, it was 2007 when I actually started to have these conversations, right? And I had just finished my doctoral degree, and my dissertation chair invited me to join this panel. And he said, oh, well, what are you charging for the panel? And I was like, what? Because I didn't know. Like, I had no idea, right? And I said, well, I don't know. Like, I'm only going to be there 20 minutes. So, I don't know, $50. I don't know. Like, and this was 2007, 2008. And he was like, $50? I was like, yeah, I don't know. And he was like, all right, well, that's fine. So next thing I know, I get this check and it was for $500. And I was like, what? This is a thing? And, you know, and shout out to Paul Gorski, my dissertation chair, who's launched Equity Literacy Institute, and he brought me in on EdChange. I learned because somebody taught me, right? And somebody taught me about how to monetize my knowledge, monetize my experience. Shout out to Chance Lewis, who's a friend and a mentor at UNC Charlotte. Learned a lot from him about how to monetize it. And, you know, and the other person is Jackie Smalls at code.org. She used to be a consultant for Discovery Education, and she brought me in to be a consultant when I was an academic. And I was like, oh, I don't have to just live on whether I'm going to teach in the summer. Oh, you can build in summer pay to your grants in higher ed. And I think for me, it was an accident that I learned about it, because I didn't know anything. I thought in higher ed in particular, the only way you were going to make money is extra money is by teaching a class and those types of things. And I think over time, when we released our book talking about race, I also learned the hard lesson that unless you're Michael Eric Dyson or like Ta-Nehisi Coates or Nicole Hannah Jones, you don't actually make money off of the book, right? You make money speaking about the book, right? And then people may buy some copies. And it also depends on whether you do independent publishing. Like, there are all of these things that I did not realize until someone told me. And I think that's where we have to do a better job in education, is like telling the story. And I think for me, it was really pivotal when Jackie Smalls suggested that I become a consultant for Discovery Education, because I had no idea. And then I look up and other faculty members in higher ed are like, oh yeah, like that's definitely the move. And then I'm talking to other people in K-12 over the years and they're like, oh yeah, like I have a whole consulting business that I do, you know, in the evenings and when I'm not teaching and in the summer. And I was like, word, like this is crazy. I never knew any of that. So I think that it's been through trials and sitting with others to learn about it. And then, you know, I've learned a lot from a new generation of edupreneurs about how it works. And shout out to Brunel Holland and Ernest Blackwell. They both have these robust strategies as edupreneurs. In particular, Ernest Blackwell, he runs a consulting company called Equity and Beyond. And I was working with him on a project, and and I'm almost 50, and Ernest is probably in his 30s, and he's schooling me about how he's built this business, right, to do equity work in a very coherent manner. And I'm like, oh, I never, even at almost 50, I never knew. And so I think it's both connecting with people, but also doing it from an intergenerational perspective. And I think that younger people have different ideas about being an edupreneur and being entrepreneurs, being solo practitioners, that I think that folks my age need to actually listen to, as opposed to talking to them, as opposed to working together to share knowledge across generations.
No doubt, no doubt. And I love the opportunity to share what I've learned and the work that I'm doing, you know, to a different audience. But no doubt the 1099 doesn't hurt, especially come tax time.
Yeah.
When I get to make those deductions because I just remember the first time I was approached at a conference by an assistant superintendent at a neighboring district. And he was like, yo, is this something that you do? And I was like, yeah, you mean outside of my district? Yeah. And he came to my session and I was like, yo, is this like a job interview or something? And he was like, yeah. And so after the session, he said, I'll be in touch. And then 2 weeks later, I get the phone call. We start talking. And when I got that first check, and I'm thinking, I made this in 6 hours. Like, this is like a month's worth of my job money. And I got this in 6 hours.
That's right.
I said, right. Oh, okay. All right. I said, there's something here. There's something here.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And it just changed everything. It changed everything for me.
That's right, brother. Yeah, that's, and the thing that's so funny to me is that when it happens the first time, you kind of like, oh, this must be an anomaly, especially if you don't really have a network of people to talk to. And then the second time when it happens, you're like, oh, this is an actual thing, right? And I'm always amazed at, even now, at that thing, right? When it happens and you're just like, this is wild, right? This is wild. Like where someone may say, yeah, can you sit on a panel and we'll give you $2,500? And you're like, and I don't have to prepare anything? And it's an hour-long panel, and maybe in an hour I might talk 20 minutes, maybe. And you cover my airfare, I get the miles, and you pay and book me up in a hotel so I get the points. Where do they do this at? Right. And I just think that it's just super interesting to watch, even now at my age and my level of professional experience of, you know, I started teaching in 97. Right. So for me, it's been a long time. And I'm still always amazed, but I'm always grateful when it happens. In particular, living in the D.C. region, like I don't, based on the cost of living in D.C., I think you need multiple streams of income in order to make it in D.C. Like I just think you can make it on one stream of income, I suppose. But I think it's really hard to do because of the cost of living. And, you know, they say we're getting ready to hit a recession. If we're not already headed that direction or there, I just think that it helps you provide cushion for your family as you think about having to withstand recessions and, I don't know, a job layoff or whatever, changes in the economy or whatever. So I think it's such a blessing. And I'm just thankful for all those who have entrusted their resources to me for those types of things. So
with that, K through 12 and higher ed as well has a tendency to repackage stuff without any real change, innovation, or disruption to the status quo. What's the formula to breaking out of the traditional thinking of what education should really look and feel like?
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna say something that some people ain't gonna rock with, right? I used to ask myself this question all the time, and I used to always say to people, why are we so satisfied with a system that clearly isn't working for enough kids? Like, it's clearly not working, right? There's something fundamentally wrong with our system, right? And I would say to folks, like, oh, it's this and that. And the first time I had a chance to be the CEO of a network of charter schools, I was like, oh, now I know why folks like Howard Fuller talk about choice, why Brother Sharif, Ray Ankrum, and the Hands talk about charters as being part of our solution. Because I think that there's an opportunity in that space. Now, this isn't to suggest that all charters are the answer. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that far too many systems, both K-12 and higher ed, people have a vested interest in mediocrity, right? People have a vested interest, a certain set of subset of society has a vested interest in their failure, right? And I always say to folks, and shout out to Ernest Morrell and Jeffrey Duncan Andrade, they once said in a book, urban school systems are actually not failing. They're actually producing the outcomes that they're intended to produce, right? Mm-hmm. They're actually not broken. Like, they're doing what they're supposed to do, which is to create a working class group of people to work in manufacturing, in particular in the Midwest. And having grown up in Detroit, when I read that, I was like, oh, now I get it, right? And I think the ability to utilize research to inform the innovation isn't highly thought of. I think people will say, yes, I'm research driven. And I'll say to folks, like, okay, well, here's research that says we need a new model of schooling. And they'll say, yeah, like, let's prolong the school day. And I'm like, no, like, that's not that radical. I'm like, let's go 45-15 and shrink summer and still have the same number of days in a school year. So if it's 183 or 200 days, there's research that talks about being in a 45-15 where kids and teachers go 45 days on, then you get this 15 days of enrichment, right? And you structure it such that teachers are compensated, kids are there, like all of these things. Because I always say to folks, tell me how we talk about summer learning loss, right? Separate from the pandemic, right? And we just talk about summer learning loss, but no one ever wants to do anything about it. Like no one says, okay, well, if it's summer learning loss, then why don't we just have kids go to school during the summer? I don't get it. But for me, and higher ed is a whole other ball of wax, right? Like I just think higher ed suffers from the same thing, right? And it's even more problematic in higher ed because they actually think they're innovative, right? And people say, well, Robert, we have online courses. Yeah, I mean, it's not actually all that innovative if your teaching is trash. Like, how does your online pedagogy align with building an online community of learners, right? And I think people have to be willing to do things that are uncomfortable. And I think, you know, that there is a tremendous amount of innovation happening, but I just think it's happening in small bursts of light, not in these massive ways in which it's either scaled deep in a community or scaled broadly across the country. And I think that it just gets to be problematic when it's there. And again, unfortunately, young people of color and all kids in rural communities suffer the most when these things don't happen. I would say to folks, like, we were able to put people on the moon. We built an international space station. We did X, Y, and Z as a society. And you mean to tell me I still have to convince you that everyone should have access to the internet and that the internet should be free? Like, what do you mean? Like, I got to pay Verizon however much I pay for Verizon. Again, I ain't knocking Verizon's hustle. But if that's the case, and we know that technology is essentially what you need in order to exist in society these days, if you can't afford access to the internet, shouldn't we just make it free to you? Like in rural communities or in places where they don't have Wi-Fi or whatever, where wideband or broadband or whatever it is, like how come that's not what we're doing? And so I think there are innovative solutions to critical social issues in society, but I'm not convinced that we want it. As Pac said, they got money for wars but can't feed the poor, right? Like it's like we find money and solutions for the things that we want. And again, I'm not suggesting that we don't have a military. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am saying is that in the same way in which we saw problems within the military and all these other places, great. I'm cool with that. Like, do what you do. Like, I want to feel safe, right? I was a teacher and, you know, want my kids to feel safe. But at the same time, like, that safety should percolate into social issues and the same rigor and same vigor in which we attack social issues or military problems. We should attack social issues in our communities with innovation, because there's all sorts of innovations in the military space. There are all sorts of innovations, even at Micron. When I think about the amazing work of our engineers, like I was talking to an engineer the other day and they were showing me this new like thing that Micron was doing with contributing to the clarity on cameras. And I'm like, yo, this is dope. So we have the ability to do that as a society. What's our ability to innovate in education in the same way with the same level of passion and commitment? So I'm right there with you, but, and I'm a curmudgeon about it, bro. Like I don't hold out much hope in my lifetime that K-12 or higher ed is going to get that innovative to really create a system where all young people pre-K through 16 actually have equal opportunity and access to those amazing things that are happening.
I hear you, but they're gonna make you pay. Look, I get a, you know, we get a water bill every month.
Of course,
that you gotta pay for it, and you for sure need water to live, right?
And we figured out how to mass distribute water in America, but yet we can't figure out how to mass distribute a quality education or wireless to people. But yet, if you turn on the tap. Now, granted, if you pay a bill, which is a whole other issue, right?
Yeah.
You get water. Water comes out in the United States of America for the most part. And there are certainly pockets of places where that is not true, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a bit of an overgeneralization that say that in the United States, everyone has access to clean water, because we know that's not true, mm-hmm. as we know what's happened in Flint. And Flint is not the only place where access to quality water is not normative, right? But for a large chunk of our society, you turn the spigot on and water comes out, and it may not taste the best, but you can actually drink the water out of the spigot if you wanted to. Bathroom, you know, ain't my jam, but like you could if you was really thirsty, you know. So I just think that there's a lot of opportunities, brother.
I hear you. And working in the K-12 space, and I would love to get in higher ed at some point, but what I find is that it's just so built around rote memorization.
Absolutely.
And then it's bloated with too many standards. And to me, that's one of the number one contributing factors to learning loss, because kids aren't doing anything. If you're just making me repeat after you, and do these dances when people are saying, oh, we're going to be culturally relevant. Right. And you're doing this stuff. And then I'm getting the test where it's like A, B, C, D. But I don't have to explain anything. I don't have to build anything. I don't have to create anything. I'm only learning something just for that test. And when that test is over with, I'm done.
But here's the thing to that point, right, is that not only are you just learning things for the test, you're also learning things for a society that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
Right? Like, and as someone who grew up in Detroit, born in Atlanta, and the son of a librarian, where books were the thing in my house, right? Like, we didn't have a lot, but we had books, right? And I always say to folks, like, the current state of affairs in our society, people have led revolutions. The Arab Spring happened because of technology, right? And social media. So just imagine if people were masters of social media and masters of technology in our communities. Like, it would be amazing, right? Like, I just think that there's so much that can happen with a iPad, as an example. And I remember when the new version of the iPad came out and the guy was like, oh, you should get a magic keyboard. And I'm like, a magic keyboard? What the heck is that? He's like, yo, it'll change the way you work. Like, you'll be more efficient at work if you have this. And I'm telling you, I paid the Verizon bill to get the Wi-Fi access on my iPad and go through the internet and the Verizon network. I got my magic keyboard. When I'm traveling, I can sit in any airport I want, respond to emails, do Zoom calls with the 1080p camera on my iPad at a rate almost better than being on my laptop. It's made me more efficient. I'm much more in touch with my colleagues and those that work with me. And it's amazing, right? I can get Teams on my iPad and communicate across the world, WhatsApp, all these different things. And again, it also comes down to, I actually have the financial means to do that as well. Like, I can actually go in the store and get an iPad and then spend $400 or whatever it costs for the magic keyboard, so it all is one in one place. And it's changed my life. Just imagine if that was part of the foundation of our education system. Not only do we want you to learn to read, do mathematics, STEM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but as a part of STEM, you need to be proficient in using the tools that empower you to become a digital native in a world where digital nativity is actually the baseline for younger generations. Like, our 11-year-old can do all sorts of stuff on computers. Like, he got the whole gaming computer and this and that. Oh, Dad, you got to check this out. Let me show you. And I'm like, and he's communicated with his friends throughout the pandemic, and they haven't lost a beat because they've been able to use the gaming world to stay connected, right? And so I think that technology should be a tool for change and a tool for justice. Not just a series of standards that kids learn about. Oh, can you type 50 words on a keyboard? Or you go into some classrooms a day and teachers are still teaching kids handwriting. Like, for what?
Yeah, like, and that's disappointing.
Like, why does it matter whether you can read my handwriting or not? Like, who cares? Everything's on a computer in higher ed. I haven't gotten a written paper from any student. And I became a professor in 2007. I ain't never got no paper in, like, writing ever. Like, why does it matter? And again, I don't know the data. I don't know the numbers. I don't even know the districts. But, like, places where teachers are still teaching handwriting, I'm like, why? Like, teach me to sign my name and a signature, and I'm good. Yeah, you ain't got to teach me. Yeah, but anyway.
Mississippi brought it back, though, handwriting. They brought it back. And we don't have, now we just, it just mandated technology starting to be taught.
Yeah.
But I want to see what it actually looks like. Because I know we're going to have special courses, but what has been disappointing to me is when this pandemic hit, the federal government stepped in real good. Mm-hmm. And when it came to like CARES and ESSER money,
yeah,
they gave out billions of dollars throughout right. the United States. And so schools who were not one-to-one, they were able to get that money to go one-to-one to have those devices right. in the classroom. They were able to buy learning management systems in the classroom. And a lot of teachers were being dragged to teach online. Now, a lot of them did not do it well. And I can't put it on them because some of them were not taught well how to do it because a lot of school districts did not have people like myself whose job is to teach teachers how to do that. But when things started to sort of like, okay, we've had enough of this, let's get back in schools. Now teachers have, they sitting around with all this stuff, but they going back to the traditional. You hear so many teachers even on Twitter like, I want to go back to normal. Normal sucked.
That's right. It was terrible. Why?
Right. And now you're getting back into this classroom and your district is still paying for the learning management system. They have all these devices. They upgraded their internet and you're just going back doing what you were doing in the first place. And I even tell teachers in my own district, nobody want to hear you talk for 50 minutes.
Not a single person. Not right. anybody. Yet they do it. It's the wildest thing. Like, I don't get it, bro. I mean, I don't understand. But, you know, I think that, again, it requires people like yourself in districts to be persistent. And then it requires folks like myself to remain consistent on the outside, right? And I think, and as I think about dealing with root causes, and I've said to some folks who've asked me, on different podcasts or panels just about my experience in corporate philanthropy and doing social impact work. And I tell folks all the time, like, doing social impact work, in particular when you use a social justice and philanthropy framework, look, listen, it means that you as an individual, right, have to get to the root cause. Right. If you aren't getting to the root cause, I tell folks all the time, you know, don't call me with that foolishness. Right. And I always say to folks like, yes, I want to fund food pantries. I think food pantries are important, but that's not the root cause, because if I got to go to the food pantry on Tuesday, I'm going to be back there next Tuesday, the following Tuesday. But if you give me a job with a living wage, mm-hmm. over time, I won't need to go to the food pantry, right? And it decreases the number of people that have access to that space, right? And I just think, you know, if you put more money into education and do root cause work there, you decrease the amount of money that has to go to the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And this isn't Simmons conjecture, right? Like, it's a statement of fact, right? Based on well-documented research by senior scholars in the field, right? But yet, for whatever reason, we definitely don't do that. So I take it as a personal challenge to be supportive of those like yourself who are doing this work in schools, and challenge colleagues in philanthropy to fund work that actually is at the root, right? And certainly you do want to fund the leaves, and you want to fund the limbs and the trunk of the tree. So I'm certainly not suggesting you don't fund a food pantry, but like, yo, there's more to it than that.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even see why more schools don't offer wraparound services, right? So
real talk,
you should be offering to parents, members of your community, job service workshops where they can come and learn how you do a resume, teach them up to date technology skills so they can get a job that will require them to use G Suite or Microsoft Office, teaching them about financial literacy. So how do you manage the money that you already have? You know, doing the work for success, having clothes where they can kind of come get and do it for job interviews and prepare them for job interviews and parenting classes, and even offering for those parents who are, you know, are thinking maybe I want to go back to school. Well, how do they go back to school? Teaching them, you know, about the FAFSA and how to apply for college and those things. Just making sure that you rise the community up, because when the parents are rising, of course, they're going to affect the kids, because the kids will see they're doing this and they can talk to them about it. And when I just see how it's, you know, schools will do a little sort of outreach, as you know, but they don't really get down, as you say, to the root cause of trying to elevate them.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that I actually would push a little and say, like, I agree that schools should be the space for that to happen, but I think it should be done in collaboration with, like, community colleges and universities, right? And I think that, because I actually had this debate with somebody once when I was chief of innovation research for schools in D.C., and I was like, I actually think schools should get out of the business of doing summer school because they're not good at it. Right? Because statistically, what impact does summer school actually have other than on accumulating credits for kids? Right? Like, what have we done an evaluation on? Do kids actually learn anything in summer school? Right? Because after school programs, and there are actually organizations that specialize in running summer learning and summer programs for kids, how come you just can't take the money and use it that way? You can hire the teachers, but the teachers would operate inside of that other ecosystem that mm-hmm. exists. And then in the summer, schools can actually use their resources and their time to prepare for the fall, which is a total grind, right? Like, it is, right? It's hard. It's challenging. So why do we do that in schools? And I think it's an opportunity to change the ecosystem where we really think about it pre-K through 16 as an ecosystem, as opposed to K-12 as a separate sector, the community college as a community college system as a separate sector, and four-year institutions as separate sectors, as opposed to thinking about this pre-K through 16 to do the wraparound services that you're pointing out. Because you're exactly right. I just always think that schools aren't good at doing some things, right? And I don't think schools would be very good at doing financial literacy in and of itself. I don't think schools would be good at doing, I don't know, parent education on career development. But I do think there are universities, there are nonprofits that can help do that with schools in partnership. And I think from the school pre-K through 12 perspective, I think there needs to be a reimagining of this idea of partnership with non-K-12 entities that just hasn't happened, at least in my lifetime. And if it has, it's happened in pockets mm-hmm. Throughout the United States.
No doubt. So let's get into the work that you're doing as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Tell us about the work and the impact you're doing.
You know, I am finding myself being an entrepreneur through my role as the head of social impact at Micron. I'm also a partner for Equity and Innovation with Equity and Beyond and my colleague Ernest Blackwell, and do consulting for nonprofit HR on diversity work, right? And, you know, still do work with the university and speaking and things like that. So I think for me, I brought those things with me to Micron as the head of social impact. And I think all of those experiences, both in the past and currently, inform how I think about social impact. So I, for me, the being an entrepreneur keeps my mind fresh, keeps me engaged intellectually, as opposed to kind of the day-to-day of being a faculty member, the day-to-day of being head of social impact and STEM programming at Micron. And I love both of them, right? I enjoy my colleagues and the work I do at American University, love my colleagues at Micron Foundation and at Micron Technology and the work that we've been able to do to support all sorts of amazing things. We're getting ready to partner with an organization out of New York, shout out to STEM for Dance, to really look at the ways in which girls of color engage with STEM through dance, right? And how do you do that and like really look into work with them? But I don't know that I would have the innovation inside of me to think about STEM for Dance without having my entrepreneur outlets, my academic outlet, and my previous experiences, both in nonprofits and in K-12 and in higher education.
All right. So how do you decide on sort of the work and the services that you do? Because the thing about an educator, particularly in K-12, you are responsible for so many things in that classroom. You do so much in that classroom. And so when you're thinking about this is some work that I want to do, you have to scale back because you can't do it all. So right. You got to figure out what is that one problem that you are going to solve? What is going to be your lane? What is going to be that niche for you and how you're going to funnel and have a focus on the work that you do because you just can't.
Can't do it all.
You can't do it all. And I've gone to certain educators' websites who are saying, I'm a consultant, and okay, I look at it and it's like, da, 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 da. I'm like, why are you doing all that stuff? And some of this stuff don't even relate to each other. And I'm wondering, like, you're putting in too much work if you're getting paid to do this stuff, because you really need to have a narrow focus. Because even Apple, if you look at what they're doing, Apple ain't making vacuum cleaners.
Nope.
Now, I bet you they have the technology to make one heck of a one, but they ain't doing it because that's not their focus. And so when you look at the work that you're doing, how did you decide sort of what you offer and what focus was going to be your niche for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about the work that I do independently and with Equity and Beyond in particular and the consulting work that we do as a firm, everybody has a lane. So for example, right, I'll just use Equity and Beyond and projects we're working on. I don't work with teachers because that's not my skill set, right? I can talk to teachers about issues of race in schools. I can talk to teachers about all sorts of things, but I'm not the person who's going to do teacher training and pedagogy because that's just not my skill set. I haven't been in teacher education as a faculty member forever, and I've intentionally not wanted to do that because I think there are other people who are better than that than I, because I'm removed from K-12 teaching in a classroom. Most of my time is with leaders, superintendents, school boards, central office employees, because that's more germane to my experience. It's closer proximity on it chronologically to my experience. And I think it's where my passion is supporting leaders, right? And how do we lead? And I'd landed there based on what I feel like I'm good at, right? And I think, and I'm also willing to tell people, I'm not good at that. I am the wrong person for you to bring in to train teachers how to teach the Socratic method in a STEM classroom. I'm not. But if you want to talk STEM curriculum design, I can do that. In particular, STEM for Equity, I can do that and help you design it. If you want folks who are doing this in the nonprofit sector, I can connect you. And I think for me, it's about a level of humility. But also, I think what a lot of entrepreneurs do is that they chase every penny and nickel. And I think what happens when you do that, it dilutes your, it dilutes what you are able to do. It dilutes your product, and it also limits your ability to go deep and demonstrate a particular expertise, right? And I tell folks all the time, if you drop me in a classroom and say, oh, well, Robert, can you talk to teachers about literacy? Nah, like, I mean, give me a book and I'll read to kids. I don't know how to teach kids to read. Like, I just, because I was a STEM teacher even in K-12. Like, I wasn't in that space. So yeah, so that's kind of how I land on it.
Right. So How do you approach failure, and what have been some of the habits that you've had to get in order to build a successful business?
I'm always honest about failure. Like things that I haven't done well, I always try to reflect on why and not blame somebody else, right? And say like, man, I was trash at this, or I didn't do well at this. And I also don't surround myself with people who are unwilling to give me that critique and feedback, right? And I think you have to surround yourself with people who are both professional friends, personal friends, and colleagues, and they're gonna tell you the truth. You know what I mean? And I think about my relationship with Ray Ankrum and Heather Harrison when we do our podcast, right? And I'm always, and we have a text chain, and I'm like, I'm thinking about doing X, Y, and Z. And they're like, no, dude, that's trash. And they'll tell me, and I'm like, oh, all right, well, tell me why. And they'll give me 20 reasons, right, in writing for me to, and I think you have to be willing to receive that feedback about your failures and your development and design, or else you won't fail forward. You'll fail backward. And I think the key is failure is fine, right? Because anybody acts like they don't fail, they're lying to themselves, right? And I think I see failure in K-12. I see failure in higher education, corporate America, philanthropy. You know, if I think of the number of colleagues of mine in philanthropy who support kind of startups that don't work, I mean, that's why it's called a startup. And it's always a risk, right? Nothing is guaranteed. And I do think that that's a problem in philanthropy, is that too many people want that guarantee that this is actually going to work. But that's just not how this works, right? That's not social impact, right? There's always a level of risk associated. But in order to deal with the failure from taking the risk, you have to have people who can tell you and help you think through the why, and you not take it personally. Like, you know, that's just the nature of it. And I've had grants not get accepted, articles not get accepted. And I'll ask people, like, give me your feedback. Like, what should I have done better? And I think it's really important to have a level of humility. And there's a whole concept called cultural humility that comes out of social work and nursing that I think is important for people to become familiar with.
Mm. So before we go, and this has been awesome spending time with you this morning, Doc.
Yes, sir.
What is the best investment an entrepreneur can make in their business?
Invest in yourself. Invest in your learning. Whether it's an executive certificate program, invest in your self-care, take time away just to recharge and do no work. Leave your laptop at home. I just spent 2 days in Vegas with no laptop. Mm. I had to unplug, right? And, you know, and I had a good time at the crap table. But I just had to just sit. And I think those are the two investments people to make. Invest in yourself through self-care. Invest in yourself by always being a learner from other people and with other people.
Mm. And that's tough for educators because that investment sometimes is a cost.
Correct.
A financial cost that when you look at our salaries, for some folks, that's a hill to climb, right? And so even sometimes when I'm working with, you know, teachers in my district, and I may talk to them and say, look, you know, a great way for you to make this modeling video, this instructional video for your students, that I think it'd be really great for you is, you know, use Explain Everything, but you'll need to, you know, buy an iPad. And what do you mean buying an iPad? I'm not buying an iPad. And my thing is, and I've always told teachers, and I'll tell them on my podcast, I'll tell them in front of anyone in the district, you work for the district, but your district does not own your career.
Correct.
And when you make the investment in yourself to learn new skills.
That's right.
Not only will those skills impact what you're doing now, but they impact what you do later. So if you decide to leave the district, you take that knowledge with you somewhere else.
That's right.
Right. So this is not about you buying an iPad for our district and the work you're doing with your kids. It's about you upscaling your own skill level.
That's right.
and learning new things that you can propel yourself, because you can even take those tutorials and start selling those online. Create your own website to sell tutorials, because that new math is different from, you know what I'm saying? That new math is different. I've sat in on some classes, brother. And sir, I'm like, what are they doing?
Like, yeah, I thought 2 + 2 just equaled 4. Like, what is all this other stuff? Like, what? What do you mean? But anyway, yeah, I hear you, brother.
And they need to get, I guess, over. Now, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. I'm not in your pocket. But get over the mindset of, I'm not going to pay. Because in order for you to get to that next level, a lot of times it's going to come some sort of financial cost to get there.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you for having me, man. And, you know, anything I can do to be helpful to you and your audience, people can find me on Twitter at @Robert_Simmons3 or on LinkedIn. And, you know, would love to be in collaboration, working with some people to launch a collective impact table around girls of color in STEM. So I'd encourage people to reach out to me about that, trying to pull some funders together and community members to really reimagine how we provide funding both to organizations and young women directly, young women of color and directly, to help their STEM leadership journey. So I want to give you a shout out for having me, brother.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Doc, and they're going to be in the show notes, information, links to everything Doc is talking about. So, Doc, again, I appreciate you coming on the show. And people, you know how I do this. This podcast episode is going to be on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Simplecast, Stitcher, and Audible. I need you to subscribe and share this with your network. And people, since I'm on all major podcast platforms, I thank you for supporting me. But I'm trying to grow an Apple Podcast. So not only subscribe, but I need you to listen. Give a brother some ratings and some stars, because I'm trying to be found and I'm trying to get Oprah on the show, because I want to know that we're doing big things around here. And again, I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Robert Simmons III, for coming on and dropping so many gems, and for you to check out another episode of the Dr. Will Show. As always, people, invest in you, EDU, peace.